Save 10% on your next domain registration at GoDaddy.com by using the coupon code CHRIS1. That's Chris and the number one.
Chris had the chance to attend Microsoft Research Tech Fest, which gave him a chance to meet and learn about its leaders.
Let's go ahead and start with Andrew Herbert talking about Cambridge.
Great, thanks, Kevin. So, as Kevin said, I'm the managing director of the Microsoft Research Lab in Cambridge, UK, the original Cambridge. Our kind of geographical area is Europe, Middle East, and Africa, which is an interesting area to work with our academic partnerships. We have very strong university partners in some countries. In other parts of that area, there are emerging economies that we're trying to help them grow their intellectual capacity and their teaching and their research system. So it's quite a large and challenging area. We're about 100 research staff in the Cambridge Laboratory. Four of those staff are members of national academies. We're very proud of that. And we have a Turing Prize winner and a Kyoto Prize winner amongst them. It's our 10th anniversary. We were founded when Microsoft Research was 5 years old, and we'll be celebrating that this summer. We have to be careful celebrating anniversaries in Cambridge. The university celebrates its 800th anniversary in a couple of years' time, so it's 10 years, we're perhaps a bit of a whippersnapper in the local scene. In computer science, we're active in a bunch of areas. Computer operating systems and networks, which is where my background lies. Programming principles and tools, design of programming languages, and so forth, led by Luca Cardelli. Machine learning and perception, led by Chris Bishop. And our most recently founded group, Computer Mediated Living. You'll see a demo of theirs downstairs, led by Ken Wood. We also have a very strong activity in computational science, which is computing being used by scientists to advance the state of the art in other areas of science, particularly in computational biology and computational environmental sciences. That we run as an external research program, collaborating with people in other universities, with scientists from those disciplines, looking to see how we can use computer science ideas to accelerate what they're doing. As part of that, we have two joint centres, one with the University of Trento in Italy, which is our focus for the computational biology activity. And we have a joint centre with INRIA, which is the French national government research organisation for computer science in France. In the INRIA lab, we're focused very much on topics like software verification and specification. As part of that external programme, we do projects with universities across Europe. We support PhD studentships and fellowships and run something called the European Science Prize with national academies in the UK and in France. So that's a very quick summary of Cambridge.
Great. You can give a couple minutes back to us. So next up is Roy Levin, who's the head of our Silicon Valley lab. Roy.
Thanks, Kevin. The Silicon Valley lab is the smallest research lab in Microsoft Research. We have about 40 people. We also have the distinction of, instead of being a broad spectrum research lab, as are the other labs that are part of Microsoft Research, we focus chiefly in the area of distributed systems, spanning the gamut pretty much from theory to practice. And consistent with being a distributed systems lab, we're actually distributed geographically with locations in both San Francisco and in Mountain View. Not terribly distributed, but enough. Given the focus of the lab, we obviously work in a somewhat different way than our colleagues in terms of the broad spectrum that they cover. But nevertheless, there's a lot of room for different activities. We span security, storage, privacy. We do work in web-based search. We do a fair amount of computing theory. And you can at least see two points on that spectrum represented on the demo floor today. One of our projects has to do with shortest path algorithms for graphs and practical applications of that to very large graphs, for example, roadmaps. And then in a rather different end of the spectrum, a novel approach that we're taking to the problem of programming concurrent systems. One of the more difficult problems for software writers is dealing with concurrency. And there's a booth downstairs that talks about an approach that we think holds a lot of promise for making that a much more tractable problem for software writers. So I'll give you a minute back to stop there.
Great. Next up is Dr. Harry Shum, who's the head of MSR Asia.
Well, in Beijing, we have Microsoft Research Asia that was founded about 9.5 years ago. By now, we have about 200 researchers plus about 100 software developers in the lab. And the lab, of course, in addition to all this wonderful research work and technology transfer to Microsoft products, we're also responsible for university relations and the collaboration with the top research universities in the Asia-Pacific region. So I'm also responsible for working together with those professors and the students in Japan, Korea, you know, China, and the regions like Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Australia, and other places. Over the last 8+ years, we really have grown quite a bit. We also, you know, not only do a lot of research, we also run this very successful and massive internship program. Many of you might be very interested. We have any time of the lab, you go to Beijing, you might see about 300+ students working in the lab, with us. Many of them are graduate students from China, Korea, Japan, and the United States and other places. Our research efforts in the Beijing lab, mostly we concentrate in six areas. When we started about 8 years ago, we actually focused on user interface and the digital media. Eventually, we added the network in the system and the digital entertainment. 3 years ago, we really focused a lot of our efforts on internet, search, and advertisement and mining. And most recently, last year, we started a new group called the Theoretical Computer Science and focused a lot of new challenging problems in theoretical computer science. Overall, I think we are seeing this sustained growth in the lab and a lot of young talents really growing up in the last 8 years and doing a lot of things for Microsoft and for academia.
All right, thanks, sir. Next up, Dr. Rico Malvar, head of our Redmond Lab.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure being with you. I just got this new job. Rick Resch didn't give me much of an alternative, which I enjoy very much, of managing the Redmond Lab. We are the largest of the labs, but by a little amount. Probably, if I did my math right, Harry mentioned 300. I'm about 330. I think I have only 1 year to go, and then he's going to beat me. But that's okay. We like
check
that
when you get back to your
office. Right? At the rate he's growing, it may take just a few months. And here in our lab, we have the largest variety in terms of number of areas. We have, last time I counted, 25 groups, but in a few months that number grows to 28. So just to give you an idea how dynamic we are, we're always creating and sometimes shrinking down a group, inventing a new one. And that's how it has to be. Technology changes super rapidly, and we just gotta move with the pace. And it's a completely, like in our labs, basically a bottom-up process. I mean, the researchers come up to me, we have to do a group on this, we have to do a group on that, and go, whoa. And eventually we do follow some of their ideas, and our tough job is prioritizing that, but letting them unleash their potential. And we have so many areas, from math theory and algorithms, user interfaces, community technologies, you saw an example today, systems, networking, databases, media, speech recognition, natural language processing, computer vision, image processing, and I could go on, but I won't. You have some background material. And it's really a great place to work, the best place to work. I feel really lucky. I mean, I'm pretty sure we all share that, having the opportunity to manage such a great set of people. As Rick said, the way we grow collectively our labs is almost like building a top-notch computer science department of the university every year. So it's really tough. That's why we're super careful about hiring, because that's the key thing. If you're very careful, then you just let people do things. We think we try to do, and we do quite well actually, interacting well across the lab. There's so many examples of joint projects. It's a bit tricky. Right? When we set up meetings, well, what time is it over there? What time is it over here? But it does work well, and we also have a pretty good batting average in terms of transferring our technology to products. And as Rick said, we don't drive to that. We see that as a consequence, because if we push the state of the art and we invent the coolest new things, then naturally our friends and colleagues in the product teams will go, whoa, I can use that. And then we work together and we try to develop things. So we can't shy away from writing code, we do, and it works quite well.
Okay. Last but far from least is the managing director of our newest lab, MSR India, Dr. Ananda.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks everyone for being here. So MSR India started 2 years ago, January 2005, with three founders. We've grown to about 50 full-time staff now, and we've settled into working six different research areas. Technology for emerging markets, which is, you know, our founding group, really. Multilingual systems, rigorous software engineering, mobility networks and systems, digital geographics, which is also one of the early groups, and cryptography, security, and algorithms, in some ways, our most youngest group. You know, we hire PhDs from all over the world, India and abroad, and we've, you know, been very productive, produced probably over 60 or 70 published research papers, couple of prize-winning papers already, transferred several technologies to product groups, for example, the multipoint, which, you know, you might have already heard of, those quite a bit of press surrounding it. And, you know, we continue to do that. And as Rico says, one of the nice things about being the youngest, and I'm actually the youngest child in the family, is that you'll get to learn from all the others and you get to work with them. So you get a lot of mentorship and sort of cooperation and help, and we certainly take advantage of that. Now, one of the things about working in India is that the level of PhD research is not really the same as, for example, the US or European countries. So it's very much part of our mission, in addition to doing our own core research, to work with the Indian government, the academic institutions, especially the PhD granting institutions, and other scientific community, in order to enhance the level of PhD, the number of PhDs that are, you know, studying in PhD programs in India, internationalize their approach and things like that. So we have a very significant portion of our effort we call external research and programs, which works with the Indian scientific and research community to promote research and advance the state of the art in research in India. So we are, again, proud to be a member of this family, and I'm very happy to be here. Thanks.
Great. So Sandra has a microphone. So if you have a question, sort of get her attention, we'll get the mic over there. Or sort of finding someone first question. Let me just throw one out there for the panel, which is a couple of you have mentioned academic collaborations. Maybe, you know, do any of you want to sort of spend a minute or two talking about the philosophy of how we approach academic collaborations and maybe some of the challenges around that as well?
It's like they're throwing the ball in my direction. I guess there's a number of dimensions to it. Most of our recruits come from universities, so if you really want to attract the best people, you want to be working with them and their professors in a collaborative way. Even with the size of research organization that we have in Microsoft Research, we can't tackle all the problems, and there are other people with complementary areas of research we want to work with and partner. And the whole culture of research, particularly in the academic world, is one of collaboration and open sharing information and peer review. So we have to mesh in that world and be part of it. We go to the same conferences that an academic would do, and we submit papers to those conferences. If you like, we compete as well as collaborate with them. I think that is extremely important. Certainly in Europe, the academic community looks to us to provide leadership. What are the key important areas for research? Universities are interested in knowing that. In many European countries, research is very heavily government funded. Governments want to know what are the priorities, what are the technology trends, and they look to us to advise and contribute on that. And obviously, working that through with our university partners to make sure that we all have a consistent and joined up story. Other things which work very well for us, we don't have as many interns as Harry manages in his lab, but certainly students coming in as interns are very important to us. In Europe, people often only do a three-year PhD compared to a five-year PhD in the US. And so we take PhDs in on a postdoc program and give them a kind of further 2 years of research training. That works extremely well for us in terms of looking at young talent and giving them exposure to really leading edge research. So the relationships are very, very important. I think all my researchers have a relationship with probably two or three groups in different universities, as well as the things that we do through the kind of more formally funded outreach programs.
Yeah, I'll add a bit or two on that. It's no accident that all of the MSR locations are very close to top flight universities. And the physical proximity, of course, makes it very easy for people to flow back and forth practically on a day-by-day basis. In the Silicon Valley lab, we're fortunate to have several excellent universities right there in the Bay Area, Berkeley, Stanford, the University of California, Santa Cruz. And we collaborate with faculty members on a very much on a one-on-one kind of basis in all of those institutions. And of course, that gives us access to their students as well through the internship programs, which a couple of my colleagues have mentioned. And also in the off season, shall I say, not during the summer, because they are close by and can come by on a daily kind of basis. And so that really expands our research scope, as well as giving us the opportunity to see at an early stage in their career some people that we might want to have be regular members of our staff.
I just want to just add on with two more points in that both of them already mentioned about. The one is really this win-win situation, the collaboration with the universities. And the other is what Andrew said, the universities and the students and the faculties actually, even governments actually, look to us for the leadership. We do, we actually take even one step further in China because given the level of computer science education, particularly graduate school level, is not as high as here in the States and in Cambridge. The university is actually really happy to collaborate with us, and we are also very happy to contribute whatever way possible. And the one thing we are doing very well in the Beijing lab is actually having a lot of our senior researchers be the adjunct faculties in the universities. In fact, we have about 30 researchers in my lab, adjunct professors in Tsinghua University, Peking University, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, and other places. That actually all worked out very well. I just want to emphasize that the collaboration with the universities, between MSR and those universities, it's really a win-win situation, and particularly those students really benefit a lot.
Okay, I'm done. One last comment, and then I really want to open up for questions.
Yeah, so this is actually one of my favorite topics, and you know, as I mentioned, the PhD situation in India is quite nascent. So a big portion of our effort is actually encouraging and motivating students, and you know, especially students who are undergraduate students and a growing economy, they have a lot of job opportunities and they may not be thinking about research as a career, so we want to promote that. So our internship program is very much a part of it. Last year we had over 70 interns, this year we will have even more, and many of them are actually not PhD students because there are just not enough PhD students coming out of Indian schools. So we take BTech and MTech interns, put them through this, and at the end of the internship, they actually have a very different idea about what research as a career is, and many of them, you know, think of, you know, doing research. We have a two-year assistant research program for undergraduate, you know, holders, BTECs and MTECs. At the end of the 2 years, they are now really committed to doing research, and some of them are leaving our, you know, lab this summer to, after finishing 2 years, to go to PhDs in the best institutions in the world, Berkeley, CMU, and places like that. We have PhD fellowships to encourage students to do PhDs. We have visiting researchers for faculty and other collaborations. And we have collaborations with, you know, a number of researchers in the peer community in India. We organize those workshops, conferences, events. We help Indian researchers kind of have a more global view in the sense that they don't travel, typically they don't, the students don't travel to international conferences. So we offer travel grants and things like that to, you know, promote that. So we've also, you know, started collaborative programs with international institutions and looking at joint collaborations with universities like UC Berkeley and Indian institutions and things like that. So that's something we think is very important to do.
Okay, questions?
Can I take just 10 seconds?
Watch the clock.
Because one thing that is important to mention, we actually put our money where our mouth is. If you look at my budget, we spend, and similar to all the other labs, we spend a meaningful proportion of it, working with Kevin's team also, in academic relations and programs. So not only we hire interns, postdocs, and visitors, but we actually put a lot of money into academia by opening technology centers, institutes. We actually provide student fellowships. And very recently, Kevin started the faculty fellowship program, where we give grants to promising young faculty. And that program, although very new, has already escalated to a position of a very high position among the faculty. So you can see those bright young faculty in the top institutions competing to get one of our fellowships. And so we really try to help push academia with us in the park.
Okay, questions?
Just real quick, Glenn Chapman with the Johnson Reynolds Press. Thank you for arranging all this and having us in. Just a multi-layer question, so I appreciate your patience in advance. I'll break it down. Just I'm curious about what each of you thinks the single most important area of research or the most important thing that you feel should be addressed now, or the biggest opportunity that's out there right now as far as where and what it is.
Okay, so question for those of you back in my night of predict. Asking each of our lab directors, what's the most important area of research that should be addressed right now?
So that's always a challenging question, because there's a shade of pick your favorite child in the family in that question. I think one of the things that's kept me fascinated and caused me to have a career in research is just how our industry keeps changing. I've been in the business about 35 years now. And in fact, I'm going back to the undergraduate university where I got my first degree. And I'm giving a keynote talk to help them celebrate their anniversary. The title is "Everything You Taught Me Is Wrong, But Still Basically Useful." Because all the knowledge of 30 years ago is in some sense irrelevant, mainframes and so forth. Yet many of the ideas, the computer science ideas, virtualization for one, are still valuable concepts. So I think one of the important transitions coming out of the hardware world that's a big challenge for us is the evolution to multi-core processors, the implications that has in terms of thinking about operating system structures, how we write software in that environment, what new kind of algorithms it allows us to invent in that world, and how we can utilize that to build better user experiences. I think that's going to be an important revolution driven by the hardware that's going to drive a whole series of changes in software. So that's one theme I think is particularly important.
Anyone else want to jump in?
In the context of India, when we think about what are the areas we want to invest in, it's not so much as a specific area which we think is strategically important now, but rather, where the best talent is available. And, the kind of research, for example, being in India, it's natural to do research in things that are related to bridging the digital divide. And, become an experimental test bed for the whole world, actually, to do that kind of research. And clearly, we are doing that. But there are other areas like multilingual systems, which is something very naturally born out of working in India, because it's a country of many languages. Or software engineering, because it's such a huge software industry. Much of the world's enterprise software is developed. So we find, there are things that we naturally gravitate to because of where we are, but the solutions we develop are applicable everywhere in the world.
Okay.
Can I make a quick comment?
Let's do one more and then take another question.
Okay. For example, in our case, I just mentioned we have 25 areas, and they're all my favorite child, so it's good. But we also ask relatively hard questions, like, for example, look at all of you. You're all using computers, and many of them are in roughly the same form factor. There's this box with a big screen in it, and a keyboard, and you type, and you do things. Shall we take this for granted? It runs an operating system and a document management suite. And what will it be 15 years down the road? Should the boxes be the same? What if I invented something that, as a byproduct, it took only a fifth of the battery it takes today? Now, you all would be very happy with your batteries lasting 2 days versus a few hours, right? And we actually are thinking seriously about those things and trying to really figure out, if you really want to change the game big time, what would that be?
Okay, thanks. Other questions?
Dina Bass with Bloomberg News. A number of your researchers are working in areas like search and security where Microsoft is locked in tight competitive battles. How do you make sure that the technology transfer occurs at a rapid enough pace that it's useful to the company in those areas? And, to take a past example, one of the things Rick Rashid showed this morning was TerraServer, which is a fairly well-known example of an area where Microsoft was working on it fairly early on, but another company, a key rival company, Google, wound up turning that into a mass market consumer product well before Microsoft got into the market. How do you keep things like that from happening?
Okay, so question is, if I can repeat it here, is how do we make sure that we enable tech transfer to happen fast enough so that we stay ahead of our competitors?
I'll offer a comment or two on that. I think for the experience that we've had setting up a lab in Silicon Valley in the past 5 years, the tech transfer has happened almost faster than we can deal with it, in the sense that once there is an interest in a particular area in the company, the pull is enormous from the product groups to the researchers. At any given time, probably 10% of my group is actually here in Redmond, working with product teams to transfer their expertise and specific technologies that they've worked on. And that includes search, in which we've played an integral role pretty much since Microsoft got started in it. So to answer your question specifically, how do you make sure it happens? The answer is technology transfer is a contact sport. And in both senses, you need a lot of contacts and you've got to make close contact.
Okay. Robert?
I've actually been to a Tech Fest because I worked here at Microsoft. And
actually, can you just stop?
Sure.
Name and affiliation?
Robert Scoble. I work for PodTech. I do scobleshows.com.
Okay.
And at previous Tech Fest, I've seen some incredible demos, particularly with the use of with cameras and transparent screens and stuff like that. You know, I think it's Chris Wilson. Is it Chris Wilson?
Andy Wilson, sorry.
Mangled the name. But Andy Wilson's done some incredible stuff. When is that going to turn into a product? And how do you convince people that the world is ready for a new kind of user interaction with a computer?
So, a couple parts there. One is sort of some of our technology around vision and using that for new kinds of interaction. By the way, wait till you see the stuff that Andy's got downstairs. It's going to blow your mind again.
There's more.
Are there sort of thoughts about how quickly we'll see that in products? And second part is, how do we make sure that interfaces, get the world ready for a new kind of interface?
Well, I can touch a little bit on that since Cindy is in one of my teams. That's a tough one, but to be frank, it's not the number one thing we drive for. I mean, answering the question when, I mean, we all would like it to happen as soon as possible. That's why we actually bite the bullet. I think that's in our culture, that we not just have the researchers, but we have software engineers. In fact, if you look at for example, just the Redmond Lab, most of the software engineers that work in research actually have PhDs, because then they can interact very quickly with others. So we do our part in making our ideas into code as well as we can. We don't know how to write product code that well. We don't want to write product code that well, but we write the reference code so that our friends in the product teams can have a good jump start. And in a few cases, like the one I mentioned this morning, where we transferred the new neural network engine into search, from the time they said, wow, we need something like that, for it to be shipping, it was actually less than 1 year, right? And they took a big bet on us and said, wow, we're really going to ship this? We did, and it worked very well. And in other cases, like Andy's work on revolutionary interfaces, then we have to be careful about our expectations, right? So we hope to be as fast as we can, right? But it's not really our call, it's their call. But the good thing is that they always know enough about what we're doing so that they can pace and plan at whatever they believe is the fastest possible.
Yeah. I just asked you because I had dinner with Douglas Engelbart, who developed a lot of the concepts that we use today on these little boxes. And he was very frustrated, a very frustrated researcher. He got kicked out of the research world, right, because his ideas were too weird, too out there. And in 1970 or 1960, his ideas were fantastic. I mean, we take them for granted today, but back then people thought that computer users would be like secretaries, word processors, not people playing Second Life or using, you know, speech recognition on computers. How do we get the fantastic stuff out and past the product guys? Because when you're working with a committee, committees kill things. They say, no, it's not ready. No, the world's not ready for this. No, it's we can't turn that into a product. How do you get the ideas? Because the ideas that you guys are playing with are fantastic. We're going to see demos. But how do you get the product teams to actually see that there's value there that the market is ready for?
Can I pick one up, Kevin? Mm-hmm. If I can kind of answer the general question, not in the specific context of Andy and his displays, I think a number of things. As researchers, we challenge the senior executives. There is a process known as the Bill G Review. It's now kind of widened out to Bill and Craig and Ray Ozzie. There are something like four or five of those a year, and we show a batch of research projects, and there's quite often some provocative things in there to get their attention about other possibilities, and that's a way to communicate to the most senior execs, here are some things that might change the business. So that's one process. Many of us in our research collaborate with other industry partners where it makes sense to do so, and particularly in the world of hardware and devices. Microsoft is not, it's a software company, a hardware company. A lot of that is done in partnership, and that's a way through our licensing programs to make that intellectual property available. And indeed, we have a mechanism called IP Ventures. I've done an IP Ventures activity from my lab, and I think some other labs have, where we work with the venture capital community to build a company to take a Microsoft research idea and go and find out what the business is. And often the challenge is you've got a great piece of technology, but you don't actually know what the business model is or how to take it to market. IP Ventures is a great way of doing that. Microsoft is one of the investors in the company, and you can see where it's going. We did something with peer-to-peer technology last year. A company who had an application which peer-to-peer would accelerate and extend. There's some things that went in Windows that the Windows guys wanted to do at the lowest protocol level, but to understand the applications and where they might go, a small company has perhaps the agility to do that and find those new markets, new opportunities. So there's lots of different mechanisms that we can use.
Right. I'm going to take a shot at answering this, too. Partly what Andrew just said, there isn't one way we do this. We try lots of different things. We know that having a diversity of approaches is important. But the other part is just, you know, sort of simply persistent. Right? You look at, you know, Tablet PC is a great example. Tablet PC actually started as a project in Microsoft Research. And one of the things that really points out to me is MSR, Microsoft Research, is a partnership organization. We partner very closely with our product groups. Right? We don't think we're the experts on our products, you know, Microsoft's products customers, on a legacy code, on all the engineering issues that involve in shipping a product like Windows or Office or even the Zoom. Right? So we partner with them very closely. But Microsoft is also a partnership company. Right? You know, you see it's taken a long time to, you know, over years to really get mainstream adoption of tablet PCs. But by partnering with a number of different hardware vendors, right, you see, you know, a wide set of different form factors for tablets and other kind of, you know, portable PCs out there, which I think is a great thing, right? And having that kind of diversity out there and letting customers decide what they think are the right different kinds of form factors is a super important part of this process, right? We try very hard not to be dictatorial about this, but to really listen and partner and try a diversity of different approaches to make this happen.
Just want to add one comment to this. So the other last thing, point I think it's a long-term commitment. You know, Microsoft Research has been around for 15 years and will be around for plenty more. And I think as a researcher, when you're around that long and you know that you can keep on continuing to work on your stuff and keep on going back and look at when the right time is, there's no frustration.
Okay, next question.
I'm Todd Bishop from the CLPI. How big of a focus is security in Microsoft Research these days? What do you expect to be able to deliver to the product groups within the next year? And how significant will those enhancements be in terms of changing the overall experience for average computer users?
Okay, what are we doing around security? And I, you know, particularly ask Rico and Andrew to respond to that.
Okay, I'll start. We actually have a cybersecurity team doing many interesting things, including the work, I'm not sure how much of it it will be here, but some of it will on, and some of it is also available in that research team's website, is on finding the sources of search spam, right? Because that is a big problem, because it not only is a problem because it hurts the business of companies trying to provide you search results, but it hurts you. Sometimes, just because you mistyped a little letter, or even if you didn't mistype, some things show up first in the search results, just because people put those parking domains and cross-linking a few pages. They basically fool the search engines to think that that result is relevant. And that hurts you, because then you click on it, oh, what is this? It's not what you're looking for. And it turns out that we can identify those sites very quickly. Another one is what we already introduced in Vista, and we have new ideas that will come up soon enough in updates. I can never tell you exactly when they come, but they will come soon enough, which is even improving phishing technology to the point where you can get caught in the phishing, go all the way into the phishing site, start typing things, and still they won't have access to your accounts, right? And so those are very important things, because it hits you right on a concern that you and the site servers have this phishing thing. And others include security of networks, like, for example, identifying, using machine learning techniques, in this enormous volume of text of traffic that a proxy server, for example, has to deal with, what patterns in there identify that some kind of virulent thing is trying to go through, right? And it's interestingly enough, because the answer is yes, you can find, the same way we find patterns in DNA to try to design a virus vaccine, an AIDS vaccine, we can actually find patterns in network traffic to identify when some, and many of those, and those, some very soon, in less than a year, maybe, and others a little farther down the line will continue to show up.
Andrew, anything to add?
Yeah, I think, and one of the things that's fascinated me, in the 10 years of the Cambridge lab, we've always had a security group, but actually the focus has significantly changed. When the lab started, security was seen as an engineering problem. What could you do with operating systems and network protocols to kind of build a security cocoon around your applications, around your computers, so that people couldn't break in? And that got us a certain wave of security. But now the emphasis is much more on security as a programming challenge. And there are kind of two sides to that coin. One is, what can we put in programming languages and programming tools to make it easier for people to build applications that are intrinsically secure? So they can think about the security properties of applications, how things relate to each other. So it's not a band-aid you stick on afterwards, it's something intrinsic to the construction. And then the other side of the coin is, how can we make sure that the software that our languages generate can be checked, that there aren't the security holes and bugs in it that allow some of the attacks on the systems. And so those are actually two very strong strands of what goes on in the Cambridge Program Principles and Tools group. And in fact, the security group used to be separate, is now a subgroup of that area. And they've been doing things like languages for expressing security policies of quite complex kinds, doing some work, in fact, with the British National Health Service, who are trying to set up national patient record systems. And you can imagine the security implications of those are quite challenging. How might you actually model those things so you know what you're talking about? We've been looking at how we can verify the security of complex web services, software glued together on different machines owned by different organizations, and a lot of work on things like verifying that device drivers are correct and larger pieces of software. So no, my summary is security has moved from being an engineering problem to being a programming problem, and the research agenda has followed it for the kind of stuff we do in Cambridge.
Okay, question back.
I'm Chidu Rajgada from the Times of India. I'm based in Washington, D.C., so there's a mild political element to my question. You have facilities spread across four countries, five labs, three continents, and there's probably a lot of movement of people and ideas. So I'm wondering if you experience or if you foresee problems in movement of people and ideas. Does someone keep an eye on what's happening in Washington? Are you happy with the current state of affairs, with the laws, with what the Congress is doing?
Okay, so the question is around sort of observation, the fact that we have labs spread around the world, and are we running into issues around people, you know, the free movement of sort of people and ideas as we try to get our research job done?
I can tell you a minor problem we have in China, and this visa issue has becoming, you know, really bothersome to us. Every time I talk to the embassy people, who are very, very nice, and we have a wonderful relationship with embassy people in Beijing. But the problem is that now they have this visa application process, which is so much longer.
So Harry, yeah. just to sort of clarify here, right? You're talking short-term visas, somebody like short-term coming into
visa.
The U.S. to go to a conference,
that's a good,
like immigration
visa. Let me try to be very clear, it's a minor issue, but it does bother us. Is actually our staff members, you know, when they apply visa to United States, sometimes it takes so much longer time as opposed to, you know, several years ago. And it's a problem that we just have to deal with. We always get the visa in the end. It's just the process that. But we work together with the, you know, embassy people, you know, very closely, and hopefully the problem can be addressed.
Any other comments on this?
It's not a problem unique to the U.S.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question.
So thanks, David Flynn from the Sydney Morning Herald. Rico, this is a question for you. I'm wondering if you could describe the process of going from a what-if concept of raw research into a technology or a product in the real world using perhaps the example of Windows HD photo format, as an example of how you make that transition? What are the key steps involved?
Okay, well, since you touched on HD photo, and I happen to be the researcher who did most of the work on HD photo, that's easy. I knew you had done your homework. It was actually a great experience because it's a working together with the Windows Media team, which happens to be one of the teams that back in the early 90s, the effort started by Rick Reshin and Microsoft Research, very quickly graduated to a product team because at that time, we were already talking about what's going to happen to media, right? And the idea that CDs are going to, at that time, CDs were very popular, but we were already forecasting, well, CDs will disappear, and movies are going to become high definition and all of that. And what we saw when we started the work on HD photo was actually a long time ago, more than 7 years ago, where we're trying to envisioning what are the limitations of technologies such as JPEG, right? And if I ask you, any of you, how does JPEG work and all of that, you'd say, should I care? No, right? There's one good thing about JPEG. All cameras take pictures in JPEG. You take the little card, take to the drugstore, and you print. Because at the end, it's all digital, but you still want to print and share it with your friends. Or you take up that thing and send in an email. But there's lots of limitations. When you go and print, you get the printout and go, oh, it's okay, but all this washing, all the dark shadows went away. Because the limitations of the technology. Then we, many years ago, we figured, what if we take away the limitations? For example, if your camera is capable of taking a 100 megapixel picture, and some may not be, but maybe you stitch things together, how do you move a 100 megapixel picture around? How do I show you a preview of what that picture looks like without having to decode the whole thing? So there were many issues that we figured, we need to flip this. We need a new technology that allows much finer shades of things. And then we brought this idea initially to the product teams. Their usual first reaction is, yeah, Rico, you come with those crazy ideas, go away, right? And it's fun because those are my friends, people we already know. But then little by little, we start working together and we listen to them. That's another good thing that Microsoft Research does. I mean, we don't try to pick up our ideas and throw over the wall and call that technology transfer. We show them some of our ideas. They go, what about this, what about that? I can't do that because my product does this, and we go, oh, we go back to the drawing board, and we try to listen to them and understand them. So and that process may take a long time, especially on technologies such like that actually involve a format. You don't switch format on anything that easily, right? Because you buy some camera or you have some software, you don't want that thing to be thrown away. So for HD photo, for example, we know that for it to be successful, it has to be a whole ecosystem. Your drugstore has to have a machine that prints HD photo. Your camera has to be able to take a picture. And we're working in all of those dimensions. So it was a big bet in that sense. It's not just a plug-in here. You have to build a whole ecosystem. But that's one exciting thing about Microsoft, that when we see HD photo is a small example of many other technologies. When we see the need to build a whole ecosystem so that people can actually benefit from that, we go ahead and do it. And it may take some time. But we do it. And the key thing is working together with the engineers. I actually wrote code, and actually 2 weeks ago I got a call from one of the product teams saying, Rico, we identified a small bug here and we mapped it to your code. So please go ahead and debug it. And I go, whoa! And I did, and it worked. And it's like, and we all have that feeling. So it's that we understand what it takes to pick up technology and put it in a real product, to really do our best. To do that. So, and then we little by little take these barriers to bring the technology. And then ultimately at the end, it's not us in research that bring to people. It's our friends and product teams that actually make it real. But we help them as much as possible to get all the way there.
Just real quick, just bring it to today. What's, for you guys, what's it like being here today at TechFest? Is this a pilgrimage to Mecca? Is there a competition? Is there like, oh gee, I hope mine's better than his? Like, what's it like for you guys to be here doing this?
Okay, we'll just finish up on that. What's it like, just your thoughts on what's it like being here today?
It's a fan reunion and all of the above.
Right?
Yeah, it's a blast. I actually don't think of it as a competition. I actually learn an enormous amount about what's going on in the rest of Microsoft Research from this event. And that's part of the reason that I essentially bring my entire team here from Silicon Valley so that they can do that too.
Yeah, I pulled 64 out of 100 people at Cambridge here.
that valuable for me.
It's really the opportunity that we get to know our customers. So our product people are really our customers of our technologies. It's really a wonderful opportunity to, you know, show to all those customers.
Yeah, we have 40 people here from India. They're going to meet 7,000 people tomorrow. And I think, you know, they'll learn a lot.